It's spring. So maybe that's practice, just so we can walk and appreciate the change of the seasons. But we know things keep intruding on that ability to just be present with things. So we've been speaking the last couple of weeks about anger, defilement, creation of anger, and how that closes us down. And we started a couple weeks ago, with the Dhammapada, where it says, hatred, that one translation, hatred does not end by hatred, it can only end by love. Then I brought in another translation I like a little bit better, which says, irritation or hostility, I can never end by more hostility and irritation, but only by non-hostility. Being able to have the capacity to kind of still and calm our minds. And then we study a little bit about the instruction in one of the early sutras, the Kaya Ashariputra, where he was encouraging us to people that are angry, and perhaps ourselves too, but he was thinking of other people that are really angry, to think about them as like you would a sick person, like they're hurting, they're in pain, and they're causing pain to other people, and to kind of approach it with that sense. And now I can't remember, sometimes I can't remember where I left off. They tell you then, that traditionally there are various ways that Buddha says that the teachings can be absorbed and presented. One is that they're used to pacify us, to calm us, to soothe us to a place where we can be truly present. And then another objective of the teaching is to inspire us, to actually get us to think we're more than the flawed being that we think we are, to get us to be able to have a more exalted sense of our capacity. And those of you that have ever read the Lotus Sutra, which is actually the sutra that's probably read in China and Japan and Korea more than any other sutra, the whole sutra is directed at that, to get you to inspire you to really see yourself as a bodhisattva, as not somebody that doesn't have the capacity to realize that. And it also has a sense, an ability to kind of magnetize us, to get us to see and that we are Buddha, that our mind has a greater capacity when we can abide in a sense of stillness and openness. That really is being awake like a Buddha. But then the other one is that actually the teachings tell us that there's capacity where you have to say no. Greed, hate, and delusion when it rises. Delusion when it arises. Greed in the sense of, in our society, over consumption of resources, perhaps, or hatred in the sense of buying other people, making them other. Racism, and then delusion, the sense that material wealth and acquisition is going to be the road to happiness, or individualism. Just keep focusing on yourself or your own country. Delusion of that leads suffering. And so we then started to explore a little bit like what one of the teachers said is maybe there's a difference, in anger. Could there be a difference in anger? That if anger is used to clarify and to arouse our energy, maybe that there's a useful purpose for that. When anger is used more to just defend our sense of ego, our own opinions, or certainly where it arises for me, or maybe most of us, is when we get insulted, right? Or somebody doesn't. How quick anger can arise. That would be an example of where anger is clearly in the realm of aggression. So we'll speak a little bit more about it. I've been kind of doing some more investigation about it. Mostly the idea that meditation is such a wonderful antidote to anger and to irritation. This is a capacity to really be with it in a way, really be able to be curious about it and to study it. And if we can slow our minds down enough, usually meditation practice, we can begin to see there's a gap between what happens, what the world presents to us, and then our reactivity. And in that gap is great potentiality for taking a more skillful course of action. A phrase that's always been helpful to me is that usually anger in the sense of aggression, and I like this phrase, it's usually somebody's maladaptive response to their own suffering. The phrase may be useful for you when anger will arise, and as it will. Could this just be a maladaptive response? Something else that you need to express, some sense of sorrow or fear or some need, and that it's hard for you to get in touch with that. So anger is a maladaptive response. And if we can appreciate that, the truth of that, then we can. It's easier for us to drop into a place of compassion or a place of patience with people that are angry when we see, well, this is just a maladaptive response. They're suffering. It helps us maybe to slow down. One thing that's useful to look at, you know, me as a therapist, one of the things that I kind of try to explore with people is, what was your family system like? What was your conditioning like? Was anger encouraged in your family system? Was there just a lot of it? Were you taught that the way to get things done was to get angry? And if that was the case, then probably you'll find that you continue to use modality. Easy default for you. Or maybe you came from a family where anger was not permitted. There was no room for anger. And then that could lead you to a place of suppression where feelings come up that you need to honor. It's very hard for you to stay with it and honor because I think we're all, if we're honest, we're kind of afraid of anger. When we get angry, we have a sense of, we lose it. You know, often a sense of shame, not in control. Kind of afraid of the energy of it, either acting out, you know, but also pressing it. So the idea being is, how can we find that place in our practice of where we don't act it out and we don't press it? And I think our meditation practice is the best way to be able to do that. So when you're angry or irritated, the hardest time to practice when you're in that state, but it also can be one of the most useful. Because you can see how you feed it. You can see, oh, you actually, physically, you have a felt sense of it, how it grows in your body, how the mind creates, as the Dhammapada follows from your state of mind. And you can see, begin to see the connection so much easier. I wanted to share something with you that I kind of interesting. There's a little book here, most of you probably never heard it. So Ken McLeod, Ken is the same one that I was referring to last week when he was saying, maybe there's a useful way to use anger. You know, if it's used in the sense of addressing in a compassionate way some injustice. So Ken is a very devout practitioner. He's done at least 1 3-year retreat in the Tibetan tradition. That's a 3-year, 3-month, 3-week, 3-day traditional retreat where you pretty much sequester yourself. Usually they give you a little hut. It used to be a cave with a little stream running through it, but now it's usually a block house or something. They have set up in various places. I know there's a retreat place in Oregon and in Kala Rinpoche's lineage in Canada, and then there's several that are in France. And he can get at least one, and I'm pretty sure he did 2. So that's 6 years. Pretty much, you know, 12 or some hours a day meditating. Given instructions, this isn't just meditation. I used to do a lot of chanting and visualization in that practice. But so he's speaking here, and as he went in, his teacher, he was working with the Lojong slogans, which we've been studying in here on and off. The 59 slogans, the Lojong slogans: drive all blames into one, turn all difficulties into the path. And he came across this teacher that had. Called the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, and his teacher gave him this one slogan, one of these 39 slogans that said, "If it's better for me to be ill, give me the energy to be ill. If it's better for me to recover, give me the energy to recover. If it's better for me to die, give me the energy to die." You know, I think you could synthesize that in the Zen tradition, and when we say, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." We practice accepting what the universe brings us and trying to be with it in the most skillful way possible. Accepting it first and then deciding what is the skillful response. And so he kept turning that phrase, and he talks about how difficult this was. Let me just see if I can find that place where he talks about that, because it was kind of useful. The intensity of the practice in the retreat brought up deep-seated blocks that broke me physically and emotionally. That's one of the things I've talked to some people that have done these retreats, and basically he says, yeah, everybody goes a little crazy, you know, because they're so intense, you know, 3 years pretty much in isolation. Often I was too ill to be assigned practices. Nothing I read helped, nor did any of the advice I received from my teachers or my retreat director. All I could do was endure the physical pain and emotional misery as best I could. So he's learning, you know, hard way to learn about acceptance. But that's part of what this particular course does. And in some ways you experience that, even in a 30-minute period of meditation or in a 7-day retreat. You'll experience this to some degree, wanting to get away from some mental or physical discomfort. I tried without much success to keep my mind from running amok. Not knowing what else to do, I turned to taking and sending Tonglin. We haven't gotten Tonglin yet, but that's affirmatively taking in your discomfort and feeling it and then sending it back to yourself or somebody else's discomfort, what they need. Practice I knew well. And then he kept bringing up this phrase from Sokmi Zongpo, who's the person that actually wrote these 37 practices, about if it's better for me to die, give me the energy to die. You know, so in other words, he had to give up. That's what his practice was. There was some way that he had to just give up. Now it spoke to me. Physically, I was beyond miserable, and emotionally, I was even in worse shape. I was afraid, too, because I did not see how I could go on. I kept hoping for a way out. Something, anything that would dispel the pain and the depression. So he goes on, a couple paragraphs later. So this goes on for a while. He's in a crisis. He's in a spiritual crisis. He's probably thinking he wants to quit the retreat, right? One spring day, I stumbled out of my room for some fresh air. I could barely stand and had to lean against a tree for support. The acacia trees were in flower. White blossoms against a clear blue sky. Well, we have yellow blossoms here, mostly. The warmth of the sun dispelled the constant chill of our cinder block cells. As I looked around, I felt quiet in the joy of the moment and at peace in the pain. Then it hit me. This was the point of practice, nothing more. Life presents you with different experiences. Every experience has infinite dimensions. Can you experience all of them without struggling against any of them? If you can, then suffering comes to an end. Can you experience all of them without struggling against any of them? If you can, then suffering comes to an end. So obvious, so simple, so deep, and so wonderful. So then he goes on and he talks about how then he had to, of course, he would slip back, as we all do. But then how could he just continue to integrate that kind of profound sense of grace and insight or enlightening experience he had? So then he started reading about Sokmi Zongpo. Sokmi Zongpo was born almost the same time as Dogen. Dogen was one of, as I've said, the main teacher that brought Zen, Soto Zen, to Japan from China. Almost within about 40 years they were born to each other. Kind of a time of great spiritual ferment throughout the world, actually. I think St. Francis was born maybe about the same time. And Zongpo was born of a poor family, so he had a very hard time. He didn't have anybody that supported him when he was in monastic tradition, and he suffered a lot of physical injury. And at one point, but he had a brilliant mind, and he became a very great scholar. And at one point was appointed an abbot of a monastery, and they were going to appoint him to a bigger monastery. And he said, no, he says, I better better than me. He was extremely humble, and then went and did 20 or 30 years of solitary practice up in the mountains. He was one of these people. And they said he was so pure that when he was one of these people, that when he arrived at a place, if people were fighting, they would stop fighting. Soldiers would stop fighting. You know, it was one of these St. Francis stories where, you know, wolves and sheep would lay down together in his presence. He just suited that kind of presence of spiritual practice, of that kind of peace. So I wanted to read you verse 20 from Tsongkhapa. So Tsongkhapa comes out with these little phrases, these aphorisms, and quite a few of them are directed towards when you're insulted or when things don't go your way. What does the Bodhisattva do? So he presents, of course, a very exalted idea of what to do, which is basically not to succumb to your anger. He takes a very strict position. This is anger is violent that you shouldn't. In a minute, I don't know if we'll get to it today, but I also want to read from Daniel Goldman's book. Some of you have read this one, Destructive Emotions. And there's a very interesting discussion here between the Dalai Lama and three or four Western psychologists about whether it's appropriate to use anger. And again, what they bring in here is more in the Western perspective. Maybe there's some way that more the strict approach to Buddhism is being informed a little bit, because in our culture and society, we sort of value righteous indignation. And maybe, and this is just like psychology, Western psychology is informing Buddhism, maybe our sense of social injustice is in beginning to inform, because Buddhism changes as it goes to culture. But let me give you this approach. So this, I'm going to give you Tsongkhapa, and then I'm going to read you Ken MacLeod's commentary on it, which I think is quite brilliant. Because when he's coming, the point that he's coming at is, how do we use meditation to be with our anger, hold our anger in a tender place? And I'll build on that next week. Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful book on anger, where he talks a lot about that, about anger, like a little child. You can't, you know, shame it. You can't even try to get away from it. You have to actually go towards it without expressing it. But let's see what Ken says. But here's what Tsongkhapa says, his verse. If you don't subdue the enemy inside, your own anger, the more enemies you subdue outside, the more that come. Muster the forces of loving kindness and compassion and subdue your own mind. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. You feel anger, you have to somehow arise the antidote of love and compassion. See what MacLeod says about this. He doesn't totally agree with that. Tsongkhapa Tsongkhapa talks about anger, yet he uses the language of war. Enemy, subdue, muster, forces. Is he saying you should wage war against anger? Or is he speaking metaphorically? Forget metaphors for a minute. If you do not resolve your own anger, you experience the world in terms of opposition and conflict. Because that's how anger presents the world to you. No matter how many people you frighten, intimidate, lay into, or beat up, all it takes is another disagreement, another vexation, and you are fighting again. We all know that right by now. You have to stop that. If you keep getting angry at something and you keep pushing it away, the universe will keep presenting it to you as an opportunity to work with it. One kind of person keeps irritating you, and you keep getting angry at that kind of person, that person will keep showing up in your life. Now back to metaphors. You are a ball of fire, a red-hot iron, a vat of molten copper. Anyone who comes near you feels the heat. If they miss their cue or make the slightest mistake, he likes the hyperbole, but fire roars from your mouth and engulfs them in flames. The more people you incinerate, the more alone you are. The more alone you are, the more sensitive you are, and the more people you incinerate. The pattern keeps going around and around. Welcome to hell. One of the hot hells, to be precise. If you don't, this is interesting what he says here. If you take Tsongkhapa Tsongkhapa's advice literally, you're going to stay in hell. When you wage war on anger, even with the forces of loving kindness and compassion, you are still waging war. A war on hell means you are in hell. War is not the way out. It's a little bit different here. I just want to tell you before, more the traditional early Buddhist approach, which is really to apply the antidote of anger, I mean of metta and compassion. And the Tibetan approach is more what we call the Vajrayana approach, which is to get in and activate, you know, not activate the anger, but to work with it, not try to impose something on top of it. So that's kind of a different approach between the two, even in Buddhism. And he's taking the approach, even though Tsongkhapa is actually a Tibetan, he's saying, no, he says, I think there's a better way to do it. In Buddhist practice, there are basically three ways to work with anger or other strong reactive emotions. You can dissolve them, you can employ them, or you can transform them. To dissolve anger, experience it. Experience it without expressing it or repressing it. Now, in all three teachings, yeah. To return to the language of metaphor, your anger is a frightened, scared, hurt, and lonely child having a tantrum. Pretty much Thich Nhat Hanh's position. Hold that child tenderly in your attention. Tenderness is where the forces of loving kindness and compassion. Do not try to make her do anything. Just hold her. Let her cry. Let her rage. Do not react to her pain, distress, fear, or outbursts. Hold her tenderly with loving kindness. And loving kindness opens you to her rage. Do not reject it. You do not try to make it go away. Compassion enables you to be present with her pain. You do not try to fix it. You do not try to make it go away. You cannot make it go away, of course, but you can be there with it. Sit there and experience all the anger, pain, hurt, and confusion in you. That is your practice. To experience it without getting lost in it. Trick. Experience it without getting lost in it, without building on it, without keep going through the storyline. Little by little, that child feels your quiet presence. Little by little, she calms down. At some point, an understanding arises, an insight into the anger, hurt, and confusion you are feeling, and the whole reactive cycle dissolves. To employ anger, practice, this is the second one, to employ anger, practice taking and sending. This is using the on-limb practice of taking and sending. Take in, feel the anger, send it back. Take in the anger of everyone in the world. Rage, hatred, irritation, resentment, and fury. Take in their hurt, pain, confusion, and sadness. Send them all the joy, happiness, peace, and contentment you have known and ever will know. Use your own anger to move into this exchange with others. You, whatever state you're in, you realize you're not the only one. This is a universal state. You don't have to just solve it or work with it yourself. You can understand that you're working with everybody's anger. Everybody has anger. The friction between your self-centered anger and your other-centered wish to help generate energy. Own anger, self-centered anger, but then you're trying to send it out to dissolve anger. As you open to both your anger and the pain of the human condition, your own anger cannot hold and it collapses. Transform anger, open completely to the experience of anger. All the physical sensations, here he is, all the physical sensations, just a mental exercise, all the tightness in your belly, the tenseness in your back, tightness in your jaw, all the physical sensations, all the emotions, all the stories, and then ask, what experiences all this? So this is a very deep level of inquiry here. What experiences all this? When you ask that question, a shift takes place. You look and you see nothing. Rest right there and look. Look in the resting. rest in the looking. At some point, the energy of anger arises as clarity, as a mirror-like timeless awareness. This is not something you make happen. Not something you make happen. When you have the capacity to experience your anger and to rest in looking at it, this transformation just happens. It is not something you do. This last approach sounds like an easy shortcut, but it requires a high level of attention, a stability and clarity that allows you to rest and look even when you are a flaming ball of rage. If you set loving kindness and compassion against the anger, if you try to oppose anger with either of these, anger will win. The use of forces here refers not to opposition, but to the depth and power of your own loving kindness and compassion. You can experience your anger, all of it, without suppressing or expressing it. Anger is a reactive mechanism that generates energy to deal with threats to your survival. Basically, at some deep level, feel like your life's threatened. When you approach your anger itself as a threat that has to be eliminated, you trigger exactly that mechanism, like anxiety. If you work with anxiety, if you try to stop the anxiety, you can create more anxiety about your anxiety. The more you oppose anger, even with loving kindness or compassion, the more strongly the survival reaction runs. You may behave as if you are compassionate, but the unresolved anger smolders inside, whether you are aware of it or not. It leaks out in ways you do not notice, and it can flare up at any time. Practice is a puzzle. You practice to make things better. Here's the key. All of your practice, whatever you're working with, anger, jealousy, greed, hate. Practice is a puzzle. You practice to make things better, but for things to get for the better, you have to let go of wanting them to be better. You all get that? That's a key point in practice, especially in our meditation in Soto. You practice because you've got to let go of the idea of even kind of perfecting yourself or having some enlightenment experience. Practice is a puzzle. You practice to make things better, but for things to change for the better, you have to let go of wanting them to be better. You've probably heard this before, but it's important. Do the practice, but do not do it with the hope that you will make something happen. Just do it. And that's true for your meditation practice. So we'll read some more from Sokpen. See what the Dalai Lama has to say next week. Pleasure, please go out and enjoy the spring. All the plum blossoms. And the donation basket is, usually I keep it, is it better to keep it on the floor or on the table? Is it working on the floor? We're going to bring that, we'll bring that into Wednesday. It's true. That's new for me. I just ran across it about 6 months ago. Pretty interesting.
I just finished reading Your Wolf and Your Dog. It was wonderful.
Did you like it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's a great, he's a good writer, and it's a great story. I'm going to go read the next one, which I think is more fictitious. But I really like his heart, Ken Niebuhr's heart, and he's a good writer, too.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
I like to say it wasn't fictitious.